Good morning, everyone. So my intention is to talk about genome sequencing and the implications of this technology on privacy. Now, what I'm going to talk about has been, is a result of many discussions and some also early research contributions with several colleagues, notably Herman Haidai, who is with me at EBFL, and he's in the room, actually. Emiliano De Cristoforo is with PARC, and Jean Sudik of UCI, who is also the former advisor of Emiliano. So I understand this is meant to be highly interactive. At the same time, the topic is a little bit esoteric for this audience. So in order to bring us more or less on the same page, I will allow myself, if you don't mind, to talk for 25 to 30 minutes, and then we'll have the discussion. Of course, you're most welcome to interrupt me at any point in time if you have some disagreements or want to make some comments. But I think it's important to have, as this is not yet the main topic of Usenix security, we need a bit of a background to be more efficient in terms of discussion. Okay, so let's start with let's say the big picture. As you know, there has been over the last two, three decades this conversion between telecom and computing that has led to modern IT. And an old crocodile like, such as myself has spent 25 plus years in doing research in that the space. A lot of fun. A lot of things have been achieved here. Many more are going to come. However, I do believe that we need, as computer scientists, to take into account another dimension, which is this one, so digital medicine. And the convergence of those two is going to lead to even more exciting topics. And prominently in the many topics of digital medicine, genome sequencing is going to be particularly relevant for reasons that I'm going to address in a minute. So I'll put all these slides online whenever doable, so you can get them from my homepage if you wish. All this is described in a wonderful book by Eric Topol that summarizes this thrust of digital medicine. The convergence of those two areas leads to what I like to call the last inch, so the time at which the devices, connected devices, essentially get very close to our skin and even under our own skin. Okay. So the genomic avalanche is coming, so things are really going to moving extremely fast, and so this is also summarized by these plots. The first plot here on the left shows the evolution of the cost of sequencing over the last 12 years or so. And as you can see, in terms of progress, it has been even faster than what would have happened if it has followed Moore's law, which seems to be unbelievable, but is true, and is somewhat humbling for us CS people in some way. Right? So another way to look at the thing is the emergence of direct-to-consumer genomics, which is, typically led by 23andMe, a company that I'm going to describe in a minute, and also online social networks that are specialized on health, such as Patients Like Me, which is, you know, if you wish, the Facebook of people who are willing to share data about their own health. Okay. So this actually evolution has been in some way anticipated by a movie, 1997, Gattaca. Let's make a quick poll. How many of you have seen this video? Ah, quite a number. Okay, half of you. Okay, the other half, your homework would be to watch that video, if you don't mind. It's a good one. It has to be taken with a grain of salt, of course, but it's a good one. Okay, now, the number one use of genetics is, of course, medical. And one important dimension is the ability for early diagnosis and anticipation of specific health problems. This is one aspect. The other aspect is pharmacogenomics, so the ability to fine-tune a treatment based on the genetic profile of a given person. Right? As you know, not every medicament is fit for every patient. So there are websites and companies that provide advice, such as our Freedom Council, or that provide you with the ability to provide you with your genome if you want to know. And all this has been recently popularized by the story of actress Angelina Jolie, who was found to have genes that lead to a high predisposition to breast cancer and decided, therefore, to go for a double mastectomy, okay, which is, of course, a serious decision. All right, now let me give, in 2-3 minutes, a bit of background that we'll need for a proper understanding of the other topics. I need to introduce the SNP, the SNP, SNP. The SNP is actually the coincides with the fact that, as you know, the human genome is a very long, can be seen as a very long molecule, and the most of the quote-unquote values that are encoded along the way are exactly the same, except in a few locations. Well, a few, let's say, in a small, let's say, around 1% order of magnitude, there is, or let's say 0.5%, there is a difference that appear. And these differences explain the fact that we are different from each other, right, to a vast extent. So those locations are called the SNPs, right? So it is crucial, so this is really the information that is crucial with respect to the fact that a given genome belongs to a given person. So this is one important dimension. The other dimension is that there is correlation between between the values, the alleles are the values actually of the SNPs, and this correlation is called in genetic jargon the linkage disequilibrium for, let's say, historic reasons. But it is essentially a correlation. So this is one important dimension. So the key concepts now to generalize a little bit. So we seem to be analog, but we are digital. Right? So our genetic information is actually stored in a digital way that is coded along with these four values, so-called nucleotides A, T, G, and C. And in the case of the human genome, these are 3 billion letters that actually package in 23 pairs of chromosomes. And the genetic variants, okay, and especially the SNPs, are the locations where these variations take place, right? Okay. Now, the modern techniques make it possible to determine the status of large number of SNPs very efficiently. So this is what is going really to make the whole picture different in the years to come. Okay. So if we look at the whole chain, so how it works, take the sample, typically some blood. This blood goes through a sequencing machine which by photochemical techniques is able to explore the DNA and then check, let's say, the constitution of the small so-called reads that are extracted from there. And then there are powerful software packages that are able to realign that information in order to reconstruct the full genome. And once you have the full genome, on that full genome, it is possible to make individual diagnosis and therefore personalized medicine on one hand, and also to make medical studies that are based on statistics. Okay? Let me know if you have any question or if you disagree with. Yes, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so forensics makes use of completely different techniques, okay? And forensics, it is much easier, it's very crude, actually. So the fact that the fact that it is possible to recognize someone just by a piece of a hair or something of that kind does not mean that you can therefore sequence the full genome out of that, right? So that's a different distinction. Okay, so what is the threat here? The threat, hey, we're in security after all here, right? So, is of course the leakage of genetic data and revelation of privacy-sensitive data about the patient, which will lead to knowing the predisposition to disease, ethnicity, paternity, thereof access to health insurance, mortgage, education, employment. And this can be even more scary is if cross-layer attacks are perpetrated, so attacks that would combine data from genetics and data that would be found, for example, in online social networks. I'm going to come up with specific examples on that. Okay. So I have to go now through six misconceptions. Because there are misunderstandings in this field, and by discussing with many geneticists and ethicists, et cetera, we have come up with a list of those misconceptions and an explanation why there are misconceptions. Okay, the first one is that genome privacy is hopeless because all of us leave biological cells. So, you know, hair, skin, droplets of saliva on glasses and so on, wherever we go. And of course, these can be collected and one can do a DNA sequencing. And therefore, it's a lost button and we should work on something else. Certificates or whatever, right? Okay, so now what is wrong with this reasoning? What is wrong is that actually this collection of human biological samples and its sequencing is actually expensive, illegal, prone to mistakes, and non-scalable, right? So it is an attack that is feasible against one individual, or maybe a few individuals, okay? And for this reason, for example, a candidate, Barack Obama, at that time, had his AIDS remove any possible trace of that kind, okay, to avoid being sequenced and then that people would say nasty things about that candidate, right? So yes, against one specific high value target, the attack makes sense, but it does not scale, okay? And an attacker would vastly prefer to have access to the database that contains the data that have been already nicely prepared for them. Second misconception is that genome privacy is irrelevant because genetics is non-deterministic. In other words, it's not that we get bootstrapped by our genes and then our whole life is predetermined based on that sequence, right? It's not like that, fortunately, right? So genetic data as such is of little relevance because other aspects, especially the environment, the nutrition, the health style, et cetera, also play a major role in the evolution of health, which is true. Right? Hence, genetic data is of little value for an attacker. So what is wrong in this case? What is wrong is that, well, for example, in some cases, for example, BRCA1, BRCA2 for breast cancer, the disease probabilities are highly related to genetic data. So just having the genetic data gives a lot of information. And in addition to this, paternity can be checked based on that, right? As at least in Europe, we consider that around 5% of paternities are illegitimate, or let's say are not the official ones. Okay. 5%, which means that after all, ladies are maybe more adventurous than we like to believe, right? So this can also be, imagine if it would be possible for someone to know, for an attacker to know which are all the illegitimate paternities in Washington, D.C. Right, that's high-value data. And in addition to this, environmental data can be obtained from various sources, including, of course, online social networks. Okay, next misconception, genomic privacy should be left to bioinformaticians, so those who are the specialists of bioinformatics. Now, the reasoning is that specialists of bioinformatics are trained in both biology, including genetics, and computer science, which is true. Hence, they are better prepared than us, computer scientists, to address these problems. So what is wrong in this case? Would you know? I already gave the response to the first two misconceptions, huh? So what is wrong in this case? Yes, bravo, exactly, yeah, absolutely. Huh? Yes, exactly, why? Because they don't have the internet. Yes, exactly, right? So genome privacy requires a strong background in information security. So in threat analysis, protocol security, cryptography. So we are ourselves, we got completely used to that, so we don't even realize how smart we are on those topics, right? Now, such a culture is well developed about computer scientists. So as mentioned, many thanks, notably thanks to the challenge or the disaster of internet security. Yet it is not part of the traditional background of bioinformaticians. They don't have a preparation in this field. Yes? They don't, it's not part of their mindset. What they are, when, you know, making sense of medical data is immensely complicated. So they don't want, in addition to this, to have the data be encrypted. And you say, gosh, what are you talking about? Right? Okay, now, an important fact is that learning the basics of genetics is pretty straightforward for computer scientists. For example, there are many books, but this is just one example where it is possible with a few weeks of study to get essentially to refresh the souvenirs of high school, if needed, right? Okay, misconception number four, genome privacy will be guaranteed by legislation. That's a good one, huh? Okay, don't laugh. So the usage of, I have to mention that the usage of genetic data is strictly regulated, for example, in the US by a law that is called the GINA that was approved in 2008. And legislation will act as a deterrent. What is wrong with this reasoning? Well, this we know, right? I mean, so if the data can be stealthily accessed, the potential employers, bankers, et cetera, will be highly tempted to get access to those data and check stealthily, right? Without saying. And organized criminals who are usually rarely deterred by laws can misuse those data in multiple ways by blackmailing and so on. Okay. Yes, number five. Pardon? Well, the past is the future in the sense that the genomic data, the machines are just starting to generate the data, right? So, but as mentioned, I mean, as I've shown previously, the capabilities of the machines have tremendously evolved, and so the data are going to become available in the 2-3 years to come. So this would be maybe a better topic for HotSec 2015, but okay, we anticipate by 2 years, right? Yes. Absolutely, but we are still very, very far from that because there are very, very few people working in this field, and hence my call to this community. We have to wake up, right? And don't expect medical doctors to propose encryption, right? They don't know what it is, right? So they heard about it, but they don't know how to deal with that. It's not their tools, right? So we have to. Okay. You said it. All right. Now, So misconception number five. No, okay, so this actually is a follow-up on this one. PET, so privacy-enhancing technologies, are nuisance in the case of genetics because genetic data should be made available online to everyone to facilitate research as done, for example, in the case of the Personal Genome Project, PGP. Well, it's another PGP, of course, right? Yeah. All right. So medical progress is faster if anonymized medical records are freely available online. And very prominent, the most prominent geneticists claim this, right? So what is wrong about their reasoning? And they are not yet ready to admit this. It will take a while. So what is wrong here? Huh? Yeah, yeah, so that's, okay, we'll, and we'll, yes, that's one dimension, absolutely, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So now, in addition to this, medical confidentiality is a crucial component of the trust between patient and healthcare provider, right? So if we remove that, we are really going to make a major change to medicine, right? Now, if the population becomes scared about leakage of genomic data, the risk is a severe backlash on genomic research itself, right? And thus on personalized medicine. Now, my own observation is medical researchers sometimes tend to underestimate the constraints of clinical practice. something that I've observed. Now, last misconception, highly related to the previous one, is that encrypting genomic data is superfluous because it is hard to identify a person from her variants or from the SNPs. Okay, bullshit. Okay, good. Databases of genomes are usually anonymized, and even in clear text, genomic data are so complicated that it is practically impossible to de-anonymize them. Okay, this is wrong. Okay, it's a misconception. Well, we are talking about misconceptions, right? Okay, so what is wrong? Well, there are counterexamples, and we know this is to be wrong as well. Okay? Okay, let me move on and provide a few examples of recent research results, because after all, we are a research community, so we want to see what can be done in this field and what has been done recently. So I'm going to present five approaches, not an exhaustive list, but just to give you some idea of what has been achieved so far by other people and by ourselves. So first is actually related to the last misconception, is the paper a paper that appeared in Science in January, identifying personal genomes by surname inference. So the idea is the following, is that consider a man and a woman, okay, and the man's last name is Smith. They have a kid, it happens to be a boy, his last name is probably going to be Smith, and he meets a woman afterwards, of course, after some time, and then they have a boy, Smith again, right? So there is stability in the last name, unsurprising, but there is also stability in the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is passed from father to son in a very stable way. And there are specialized websites that take advantage of this and that contain, let's say, the related details. I won't dive into those details, but let's say this information can be found. It can be found because there is a high interest in genetic genealogy. So what the authors of this paper have done is they have taken the two largest public genetic genealogy databases with built-in search engines, and from this they have tried to reconstruct, actually to follow the last names of across generations, and to see, okay, this is a cousin of this guy only through a father-son relationship and so on. And there is a substantial, more than 100,000 surname, so-called YSTR. So YSTR being this short tandem repeat on the Y chromosome. Right? And so what they've done is they start from the ground truth. They know a given person, the real name, and then they take the YSTR. From this, they go to the databases, try to reconstruct what the surname should be, and infer the surname and check in what case they got it right. And in the case of US Caucasian males from middle and upper classes, they have a success rate of 12%, which is already pretty good, because it means that if you have such a success rate, then you can complete by just manual checking to finalize the attack. So the morality is that de-anonymization of online genomic data is easy and will become easier in the future. Okay, second example, this is work from my own group, quantification of kin genomic primacy. And this is going to appear in CCS 2013. Hey, CCS is in Europe this year, Berlin, so do show up. Assume this guy, so we for ethical reasons, we have anonymized him, okay? So let's call him Tom. Okay, Tom, we go to his Facebook profile. From the Facebook profile, we get his family. Okay, here are some relatives, okay? But Tom is someone who is interested in genetics, so he also has a profile in OpenSNP, okay? OpenSNP is a website where you can upload your own genome, if you wish. Okay, you get your genome from, for example, 23andMe, and you upload the file. So then, someone who is curious, as we are in our lab, can say, aha, but then we can correlate the two things, because if within a given family, of course, the genomes are highly correlated. So by knowing the genome of this guy and who the relatives are, we can deduce a certain number of things about the genomes of the people, of the other members of the family, who are maybe unwilling to have their genome online. So for this, okay, I will spare you the details. Come in Berlin, and we'll explain the stuff, but very quickly, so we take into account the background information of the attacker, so the correlation between the SNPs, the statistics about the SNPs themselves, the composition of the family, and here is, let's say, the sequence, the genomic sequence of the different relatives, and then they operate, they go through a so-called GPPM and decide which of the information from their own genome should be removed from what is going to be put online in such a way that level of information that is provided to the public remains compatible with what the family is willing to expose. So it's a way to help families who, for which some of the members are willing to expose something, to come to a peaceful compromise. Okay. Voilà. So, okay, the details are a bit more involved, but it just gives you an idea. Okay, now another contribution. This is the colleagues from UCI primarily, is an efficient and secure testing of genomes. In other words, so let me go through the picture. So if a given individual is willing to have a test performed about his own genome without revealing it, for some reason he doesn't want to reveal it to, for example, a medical doctor, so the genome itself is provided into this block, okay, but without revealing it by making use of private site intersection techniques typically. Okay, and in this way, it is possible to perform those kind of things, paternity ancestry testing, testing of SNPs, etc., while keeping the privacy of the genome itself. And they have also, in a subsequent paper, described how they implemented this. So two people meeting with each other might say, hey, are you my father? One never knows, right? Assume the other person being a man, of course, right? Are you my father?
I'm pretty sure I'm not.
Huh? Okay, right. So, and for this, so the idea is to have the genome sequence produced. So there's one shot operation, and then this is uploaded on the smartphone, and then bam, 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 and then the test can take place. So this was presented at WPES last year. Okay. Now, very quickly, I would like to keep some time for the discussion. The last example is what Erman presented yesterday at Health Tech. How many of you were at Health Tech yesterday? Please raise your hand proudly. It's a tiny minority. All right. So what was presented yesterday is about the idea of composing both genomic and clinical and environmental data in order to be able to perform tests, for example, on the population without having to reveal the content of the DNA itself and the clinical data and so on, and yet be able to make appropriate decisions. An example would be the Ministry of Health. So these are people with whom we are working in Switzerland, and they want to optimize preventive medicine. So they want to identify which subset of the population should undergo specific tests, for example, right? But they don't want to have access to the dossiers of all those people, and they could not. So is there a way to have a system by which it is possible to identify those of the people who would need specific treatment, or at least should be warned of a given risk, without having to look into the dossiers themselves? And this is exactly what this proposal is about. Okay, let me conclude, okay, and open the discussion. So digital medicine is coming, like it or not, and it will forever change the landscape for privacy protection. There's no question about that. Now, genomics is particularly relevant, so because there is thousands of people are working to make sure that to make sense out of genomic data, and the machines are more and more powerful. So petabytes are going to be produced in the coming 2, 3, 4 years, and so we need to get prepared for that. So it is highly sensitive data, huge amounts of data, complex correlations between those data. It's a complex field. It is a big data, a field that is emerging in front of our eyes. Now, this is in bold, the only sentence in bold in this slideshow. Very few researchers have addressed the topic of genome privacy. Much more needs to be done in this field. So essentially, I mean, beyond the people I have mentioned, there is also one group around Brad Malin at Vanderbilt. There is one group around Xiaofeng Wang in Bloomington. And by and large, that's it, right? So it's a microscopic number of people with respect to what is at stake here, right? Okay, more information and pointers. So here you find the information and website, web page from UCI. This is our own web page, and we have produced a survey on the topic. It's a very gentle introduction to the topic, 6-7 pages that is available online. We also have a few hard copies if you wish. Okay, and with this, we still have 12 minutes and a half, right? For discussion and interaction. So, yes?
So, for the type of diagnosis that you talked about, you know, are you my father?
Yes.
I can understand.
Am I?
Why it's necessary to have a secure function evaluation or cryptographic tools like that. But if all I'm asking is, do I have BRCA, well, not me, but if a woman wants to know if she has BRCA1, that's the algorithm for computing whether that is the case is public. So why is not the solution simply to download the algorithm and locally execute it on your genome?
This what's one option, absolutely. So this is all one possibility. I mean, there are many options. At the same time, it depends also if we are talking about personalized medicine or we are talking about statistic processing across tens of thousands of files, okay? So depending on whether we are talking about an oncologist or someone, a statistician who is now doing research and wants to publish in Nature, right? So then maybe the constraints might be somewhat different and so on. But yes, I mean, there are plenty of solutions of that nature that need to be explored, yeah. But you look at the topic, there are nowadays maybe 10 papers in total. So it's really the burgeoning of a huge field that is going to happen. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm Anoop. I work at NIST in Maryland, NIST. Here in security area. So my question is that, you know, I'm trying to understand that data protection is important for things like my personal finances, or if I put my pictures in the cloud or whatever, right? General information. So how is data protection for genome data different from protection for other kind of data?
Right, so there are some differences related to the nature of the data and to the structure. So first of all, the genomic data are extremely stable in time. So essentially you die, your genome is not going to change significantly between your birth or even the time of conception, but the meiosis and the time at which you die. And even thousands of years afterwards, as you know, it has been, scientists have sequenced people, even Neanderthal people who died, some tens of thousands of years ago, right? So there is extreme stability of the data, even more so than in financial data. Then the size of the data, right? The SNPs are, so you have in the order of 40 million possible variants. Okay, so it's pretty big. And then there is this correlation across family members, right, that makes it also even more sensitive. So all these dimensions are pretty specific to the area and need to be taken into account. If you make a back of an envelope calculation, say, okay, NIST is the US, 300 million inhabitants, by and large. So if the dossier of each of them, once encrypted, is, well, you know, the full raw data, right, that comes out of the Illumina or Roche machines, etc., is in unencrypted, is around 300 gigabytes, okay, per patient, okay, 300 gigabytes. So if you encrypt this in a somewhat brutal way, you multiply that by, let's say, 100. It could be worse, of course, right? So it's going to be 30 terabytes. Now, you multiply 30 terabytes by 300 million inhabitants, and you get an idea of, the yeah, the amounts you have to face, am I right?
Do you think this eventually this genome data is going to go to the cloud?
Yeah, that's exactly one of the another issue. So there are variations between the US and Europe. The US seems to be very much cloud happy, you know, centric. In Europe and especially in Switzerland, there is a bit more reluctance to put all data of, for example, Swiss citizens on US operated clouds for a number of reasons, right? I don't know if I need to develop this. But in any case, there must be some provider who is, which can be the government or can be a nonprofit or can be NIST, I don't know. But I mean, those data in some way will have to be stored somewhere. So is each hospital going to provide those storage capabilities and will take care of the encryption? So we talk on a almost monthly, if not weekly basis with the University Lausanne Hospital, and they are concerned. You know, they say, gosh, but I mean, you're talking about multiplying by 10 the disk space just because of genomics, right? So it's not clear what, I mean, all this needs to be debated, it needs to be addressed. The simple fact of moving the files of, let's say, 1,000 patients from one place to another, say, well, you cannot do it over the internet, just send the truck, because it's too much nowadays, right? In 10 years from now, it might be different, but nowadays you cannot, right? So are we going to move, you know, trucks around the continent for that purpose? Unclear, right? Yeah.
Yeah, just further to that, with respect to non-human genetic data, there's non-human. Already a substantial amount of it available on various cloud providers from specific pharma companies and things like that. So have you seen any work to make this sort of, you know, the initial lines of looking at privacy around that with what's already in place? Because, you know, we know if something's already in place now for, you know, mouse and rat and various test subject DNA, you know, the next step for the research side of things from a practical perspective is, oh, I want to use the same tools and leverage the same infrastructure for human genomic data.
Right. But let's say the privacy concerns of mice are different, right?
Absolutely.
Right? Right.
To try to bolt on privacy controls after the fact, or to the alternative to try to convince them to use a new set of tools or infrastructure to conduct research because of different tests.
Yeah, I agree.
That's a substantial amount of work that you need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we should not understand, I mean, I'm glad actually you brought the issue. We should not underestimate the huge amount of software effort and investment that is made in order to, let's say, find mistakes in the sequences, right? Because this is still, I mean, let me come back quickly to the, what's wrong here? Oh, I lost my VPN probably. Okay. So this is, right. So if we go back to the chain, well, the chain looks good, right? It was before the misconceptions, I think, this one. Voilà. So here, once we get out of the chemistry, right, there is, so this is pure computer science, right, processing, and it's a huge amount of, you know, we're talking about days of computation in order to find the mistakes, to make the alignment, and so on. And all that know-how, of course, can be, I mean, makes sense for, is mandatory, is required for human genome, but also for non-human genome. Absolutely. So from that point of view, there is a huge community with whom this community here doesn't have much interaction so far, right? But this is going to change. A huge community that is focusing on trying to make sense of those data and trying to make sure to minimize the amount of mistakes that are in those data. Yes.
Solving the specific problem that researchers have,
Well, the only I think the only way is, I mean, I would fully agree with what you're saying. We have to work hand in hand with geneticists, right? Yes. In my experience, they are, actually they came, I 2 years ago I wouldn't even have thought to work on this topic, and they came and say, oh, you're working on, yeah, at that time you're working essentially on location privacy, really computer science stuff, you know, and then they came and they said, look, I mean, genetics is making huge progress, and we know that all these data are going to become available. Do you think there is we suspect there's a privacy issue. Would you agree, number one? And number two, would you help us finding solutions, right? And then I started to look into this and had to refresh a bit my background in this area, I must admit. And I said, gee, of course, there's going to be a huge problem. So forget location privacy. I mean, this is something that is way more important and is going to hit mankind. Well, I think in Europe we do consider Americans to be human beings, so you do have a genome, and you know. So I think that the problem, in essence, is the same, right? Now, legislation might be a bit different, but I think there is a commonality of understanding that it is a major issue, and the tools for protection are, of course, the same. So what is unclear is, and actually this refers to a previous question, is how much the legislator is going to impose in terms of protection. This we don't know yet. And here, the somewhat split might kick in. I don't know. We will see. But after all, as you know, America and Europe managed to converge on cellular technology after a while, right? So why not here? So it can happen, right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This one. Okay. So if you are if you put yourself in the shoes of the attacker, and you have two options, right? You are interested in attacking, let's say, the population of Washington D.C. Okay. So what is the best option? Do you go for collecting samples of all the people living in this city? Or do you go and attack the database that already contains the data? Right? I mean. Yeah, because, I mean, if you have to collect the biological samples of, say, 1 million people, it's an enormous cost, right? And it has to be done stealthily. So you need to pay hundreds of people to go after and pick the hair and to say, I found this hair and it is from this person. But this might be wrong, right? Same thing for the saliva, and so on, right? So in other words, in the medical context, you get, you know, a nice sample of blood that has been collected professionally, and so on. So you start from very high quality samples. In this kind of thing here, it's going to be a huge bricolage out of low quality samples. That might happen, yeah. But okay, once again, and forensic databases are much more limited than this. It's not a full sequence, right? It's just a few markers that are enough to identify an individual, but does not provide, let's say, for example, forecast in terms of whether this person has a high propensity to develop Alzheimer's or other things of that kind, right? So it's a different thing. But maybe in the future, law enforcement agency might be tempted to say, well, after all, why don't we do the full sequencing? And we can also identify which, based on the profile, is this person particularly aggressive, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, science fiction scenario might actually happen from that point of view. Yeah.
Let's go ahead.